2001 Salt Lake Sandstone Symposium. Session 225, Reconciling the Utah Tax Code with LDS Scripture, Equality versus the Income Gap. Participants, Nick Goro and John R. Silito.
That's from the University of Utah, and he's published a number of things, including articles in Sunstone and Dialogue, and he's edited and co-edited other works, and he's been recognized as a distinguished honors professor at least three times in his career. So, Nick, we'll turn the time over to you.
Well, I'm glad there aren't a lot of people here because that takes a lot of pressure off of me. He did say I was a young scholar, very young, I think, and I was a little nervous about this and about my paper, and I was practicing my paper the other day for my father, and he fell asleep. So I hope that y'all don't, but if you want to, I hope that it provides for pleasant dreams, at least. And I'm just going to jump right into it. The LDS scriptural canon is full of injunctions that encourage us to seek for economic equality. King Benjamin, for example, instructed his people that they were to administer of their substance unto him that standeth in need. That's Mosiah 4:16. Not judging whether or not the beggar in question had caused his own plight. Jacob commanded his people to be familiar with their substance, even to the extent of equalizing. And he said that they, meaning the poor, may be rich alike unto you. Jacob 2:17. Not only are we commanded to share our substance with others, inequality, according to modern-day revelation, is the cause of the sins that plague the world. D&C 49:20 says, "It is not given that one man should possess that which is above another, wherefore the whole world lieth in sin." These and other passages throughout the scriptures lead me to believe that economic equality is not only a good thing, but a commandment from God. I believe that these scriptural statements apply to the social problems our world faces today. No one can deny that economic inequality is a serious problem. From one report said that in 44 states in the United States, the richest 20% of families got richer, while the poorest 20% got poorer between the late 1970s and the mid-1990s. This is no minor contrast. It is, in fact, quite remarkable. And in 1996, the top 20% of Americans earned 49% of the money, while those in the bottom 20% earned just 3.7% of the nation's income. This affects children perhaps the most. In fact, 20% of U.S. children live in poverty. Utah is certainly no exception to this trend. In Utah, and this is also in 1996, the richest 20% of families with children had average incomes more than seven times as large as the poorest 20% of families. And in 1980, Utahns with incomes under $50,000 earned 88% of the income in the state, and now they earn a much lower 59.7% of the income. And so that has changed even recently, or has changed over the last 15 or 20 years. And one political solution to the problem of inequality is progressive taxation. A progressive tax code can do much to even out the wealth by taxing the upper classes a high percent, the middle class a moderate percent, and the lower class little, if any, at all. In Utah, however, we have a regressive tax code, meaning that it favors the rich over the poor. The poor are required to pay a higher percentage of their income in taxes than the rich. And according to a report from the Citizens for Tax Justice, the Utahns with the lowest 20% of income pay 12% of their income in taxes, while the top 1% pay only 5.7% of their income in taxes. Several other facts also indicate that Utah's tax structure is highly regressive. And some of these numbers are from like 1997, and so if I quote something that's slightly different now, I'm sorry. Utah is only one of only 12 states that charges sales tax on food, which is regarded as Utah's most regressive tax, simply because the poor must spend a higher percent of their income buying basic items such as food and clothing. And a study by the State Tax Commission showed that for every $100 paid in total state income taxes, businesses paid just $12.06. The remaining $87.94 came from households. While this says nothing about the rich or the poor, it does reflect on the fact that consumers who must provide for themselves and their families pay more taxes than businesses do. Utah, in an effort to promote economic prosperity by attracting businesses to the state, has one of the lowest corporate income tax rates. And in fact, only two states, or at the time of this report, only two states had lower income corporate income tax rates than Utah did. And Utah grants a state income tax deduction for the payment of federal taxes, a feature that benefits the wealthy more simply because they pay more dollars in federal taxes than the poor do. And there is almost no difference in the tax rates of the middle and the upper class in Utah. In fact, there is no difference, because the tax brackets, they were not adjusted between 1973 and 2001, and when they were adjusted just recently, the adjustment of the top bracket was only from $7,500 to $8,626. And so the top income bracket includes everyone who's even in the bottom of the middle class and above. There's no differentiated tax bracket above that. And this minor adjustment does nothing to contribute towards a progressive tax structure. By requiring the poor to pay a higher percentage of their disposable income in taxes, a regressive tax system contributes to inequality between the classes. I find it ironic that, considering the LDS makeup of the state legislature, which is 85% to 90%, they are not open-minded towards a progressive tax system. And perhaps one of the reasons for this is the ideological beliefs of many in our majority Republican state legislature. According to Republicans, in one news report they said, a tax increase is a tax increase. Even if a tax shift doesn't bring a penny more to tax collectors, somebody still ends up paying more. One Republican legislator described his viewpoint this way: the best thing would be to eliminate all the exemptions and go to a flat tax. That's the fairer system. Is the role of government to redistribute the wealth? In a free enterprise, free market system, it is not. That's a disincentive to achieve. The element that I see here is that some Republican lawmakers do not desire to do anything that would interrupt or interfere with the free enterprise system, even though such action would contribute to economic equality. Democratic legislators frequently support measures for a progressive tax code or a more fair tax code. However, the Utah legislative bodies are made up of 68% Republicans, and hence the Democrats have no opportunity to pass progressive tax legislation. The most likely reason that Utahns vote Republican is probably the enduring tradition of Republican Party support in the state. However, there are underlying ideological beliefs that cause LDS voters to choose Republicans and LDS lawmakers to support the free market over political action to support economic equality. While LDS doctrine nowhere justifies capitalism, in relatively recent times, some LDS church leaders have taught principles that implies it may. Most notable and outspoken of these was Ezra Taft Benson, who, during his apostleship, spoke out time and again regarding his political beliefs. These beliefs were tied to a fear and intense distaste for communism. He taught that communism introduced into the world a substitute for true religion. It is a counterfeit of the gospel plan. And he referred to communism as the greatest system of slavery ever devised by the forces of evil. Now, these feelings on communism were shared by many during the Cold War. However, not only did Elder Benson warn the Latter-day Saints of the evils of communism, he preached a program of non-accommodation towards anything that, in Elder Benson's view, resembled communism. He taught that we must not tolerate accommodation with or appeasement toward the false system of communism, and linked communism and all programs he related to it to a loss of free agency. In the October 1963 General Conference, and I'm quoting from Michael Quinn article, he warned against those who support in any way any organization, cause, or measure which in its remotest effect would jeopardize free agency, whether it be in politics, government, religion, employment, education, or any other field. He then concluded with a long plea against the threats of socialism and communism, end quote. Benson opposed all forms of socialism and government social welfare programs and linked them to communism. He taught that Latter-day Saints should use the Book of Mormon to expose and combat the falsehoods of socialism, and that no true Latter-day Saint and no true American can be a socialist or a communist, or support programs leading in that direction. In the October 1968 General Conference, Elder Benson gave a sermon that focused entirely upon the role of the government in the United States. Now, this sermon actually said little of communism, save to tie it to U.S. social welfare programs. In it, Benson gave his ideology of how government should operate, claiming that government is no plaything. His emphasis was that the government could do nothing that the people being governed did not give it the right to do, and that people could not give away rights that they did not possess. His focus was on the right to own property, claiming that the government had no right to redistribute wealth in social welfare programs against the will of those governed, teaching, and he taught that government cannot claim the power to redistribute the wealth or force reluctant citizens to perform acts of charity against their will. Elder Benson believed that social welfare programs are a form of theft, and he said that once government steps over this clear line between the progressive or negative role into the aggressive role of redistributing the wealth through taxation and providing so-called benefits for some of its citizens, it becomes a means for legalized plunder. And Benson believed that the process of granting social benefits would eventually lead to a dictatorship-style communism. And he said that once the principle of the protective function of government gives way to the aggressive or redistributive function, then forces are set in motion that drive the nation toward totalitarianism, further stating that history proves that the growth of the welfare state is difficult to check before it comes to its full flower of dictatorship. But let us hope that this time around the trend can be reversed. If not, we will see the inevitability of complete socialism, probably within our lifetime. And of course, Ezra Taft Benson is dead now, and we haven't seen complete socialism. Benson warned that if this communist planned program of deception is not stopped, it will destroy our nation. He advocated drastic action to end social welfare programs. He said, "How is it possible to cut out the various welfare state features of our government that have already fastened themselves like cancer cells onto the body politic? Can drastic surgery be performed without endangering the patient? Drastic measures are called for. No compromise actions will suffice. Like all surgery, it will not be without discomfort and perhaps even some scar tissue for a long time to come." The subject of politics was not something that Elder Benson brought up from time to time, but a topic that he returned to often. Elder Benson was not alone in these views. Other LDS authorities and scholars held similar positions, including H. Verlin Anderson, W. Cleon Skousen, and Ernest Wilkinson, who passed these views on to generations of BYU students. Benson's position was significant in relation to contemporary Utah politics because he taught that socialism and social welfare programs were steps toward communism and that they took away man's God-given free agency. It is not hard to go from that position to one of deifying capitalism and the market economy, especially if communism is portrayed as the absolute evil in the world. A personal friend of mine once told me that capitalism was God's lower law, a divine system put in place until Latter-day Saints become ready to live the law of consecration. Such deification of capitalism surely contributes to the viewpoints and behavior of Utah's majority LDS, majority right-wing legislature, and the Utah voters who elect them. And if capitalism is a god in our economic world and its principles near scripture, then progressive taxation and other social economic reforms become grave sins. But up to this point, I have given no good reason why things should change or why we should take a good look at progressive tax policies. Benson and other economic conservatives cannot be blindly accused of being uncompassionate for their political beliefs. Surely they must have believed in Christ-like charitable giving through private channels. I cannot question their faith that such giving is effective and may even one day bring the economic equality the scriptures call for, although I do not share such faith. However, I would now like to give a couple of good reasons why we should give progressive tax policies a fair shake in Utah. First of all, we, as Latter-day Saints, do not need to feel bound to heed Benson's political philosophies as if they were prophetically inspired. At the time Elder Benson was actively preaching his political viewpoints, LDS general authorities and scholars openly criticized his opinions. For example, after Elder Benson's 1968 conference talk, first presidency member Hugh B. Brown said in a letter that Benson's viewpoint does not represent the position of the church with respect to the subject of government aid, etc. And the month after Benson made his claim that no true Latter-day Saint can be a socialist or communist, Brown countered that claim. And I'm quoting again from D. Michael Quinn. Upon inquiry by a politically liberal Mormon, Brown replied that a Mormon can be a Democrat or a socialist and still be a good church member. Brown added that he had just had a talk with Brother Benson, who was on the carpet in regard to his political sallies of late, end quote. Well, in 1971, while Benson was still very active in making his political claims, Bruce R. McConkie wrote in one of his books that brethren who go forth today to preach and to confirm the churches sometimes take it upon themselves to advocate political, educational, and social philosophies which seem right to them, on occasions even claiming they are essential to salvation, which in fact are not the voice of God to his people. Benson not only made his political claims in general conference, but also in state conferences and at institutes where he was to confirm the churches. It is possible that McConkie's statement was a deliberate reference to Elder Benson, and if it was not a deliberate reference, it certainly applies. And in 1973, LDS scholar Hugh Nibley, although not an officially authoritative figure, I feel that his ideas have merit and are worthy of discussion in this paper. In a talk given at BYU, he gave his viewpoint of the relationship between work and wealth, and he gave ideas that I feel directly contradict the political viewpoint of Elder Benson. He said, implicit, and he's speaking of the Puritan work ethic, implicit in the work ethic are the ideas of one, that because one must work to acquire wealth, work equals wealth, and two, that is the whole equation. With these go the corollaries that anyone who has wealth must have earned it by hard work and is therefore beyond criticism. That anyone who doesn't have it deserves to suffer, thus penalizing any who do not work for money. And, since you have a right to all you earn, that the only real work is for oneself. And finally, that any limit set to the amount of wealth an individual may acquire is a satanic device to deprive men of their free agency. He said, thus making mockery of the council in heaven. These editorial syllogisms we have heard 1,000 times, but you will not find them in the scriptures. And I think that this is a direct, in a way, or an attack on the free agency. This is Hugh Nibley. Yeah. And so that kind of counters the idea of the free agency theory to economics. And in the same talk, Nibley warned against those who use rhetoric or language to twist the truth. Every rhetorician knows that his most effective weapons by far are labels. He can demolish the opposition with simple and devastating labels such as communism, socialism, or atheism, pauperism, militarism, or Mormonism, or give his clients worst crimes or religious glow with such noble labels as integrity, old-fashioned honesty, tough-mindedness, or free competitive enterprise. These ideas of Nibley's fly in the face of the free enterprise anti-welfare state doctrine of Benson and his fellow economic conservatives. And I believe the second quoted reference may have been a direct response to Benson's October 1972 General Conference address, in which he linked socialism to Book of Mormon prophecies of secret combinations. And it is important to note that while Benson was a member, and I think this is fascinating, a member of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, he at various periods spoke frequently of the so-called evils of communism, socialism, and social welfare programs, both in and out of General Conference. However, he quit such activity before he became president of the church. Prior to his presidency, the references to these subjects lessened and became far more subtle. After becoming president of the church, he never spoke on the subject in General Conference. He did mention secret combinations in the October 1988 General Conference. However, he failed to link them to communism and socialism. And it could be said that that was because the Cold War was over and Ronald Reagan was president, but social welfare programs were still alive and well in America, and he did not criticize them at that time when he was the prophet. While I have given adequate reason to de-exalt Benson's economically conservative viewpoint, I still must give reason to consider other viewpoints that may allow for a more liberal tax policy. Now, Elder Benson was not, of course, the first general authority to speak on political matters, and we know that Joseph Smith was politically active. He ran for U.S. president, and he published a political platform. Now, Joseph Smith's views, although very liberal for his time, would be considered somewhat moderate today. However, he did advocate governmental intervention in the economy. In his political platform, he stated that when the people are secure and their rights and property respected, then the four main pillars of prosperity, viz. Agriculture, manufactures, navigation, and commerce, need the fostering care of government. He advocated a judicious tariff and a socialistic national bank, both propositions that I believe fall outside of Benson's view of the proper role of government. And surely, given our current economic situation and status, Joseph Smith may have allowed the fostering care of government to be applied in tax policy to benefit the lower class. Also, Brigham Young spoke out frequently against capitalism. In fact, he believed that the doing of business and pursuit of wealth was a cause of juvenile delinquency. He said, "I have not the least hesitation in saying that the loose conduct and calculations and manner of doing business which have characterized men who have had property in their hands have laid the foundation to bring our boys into the spirit of stealing. You have caused them to do it. You have laid before them every inducement possible to learn their hands and train their minds to take that which is not their own." Brigham Young associates stealing with the actions of property owners in a capitalistic system, and I find that this is in sharp contrast to Benson's labeling of social welfare programs as the means for legalized plunder. And Brigham Young also taught that capitalism goes against the nature of heaven, and hence we should not be involved in it on earth. And he said, "No one supposes for one moment that in heaven the angels are speculating, that they are building railroads and factories, taking advantage one of another, gathering up the substance there is in heaven to aggrandize themselves, and that they live on the same principles that we are in the habit of doing. No sectarian Christian in the world believes this. They believe that the inhabitants of heaven live as a family, that their faith, interests, and pursuits have one end in view, the glory of God and their own salvation, that they may receive more and more. We all believe this, and suppose we go to work and imitate them as far as we can." I believe that Brigham Young's purpose in this statement was to tell the Latter-day Saints that their duty was to imitate those in heaven, not to be chasing after property and trying to gain money. And I also believe he was telling them that capitalism is totally alien to the order of heaven. Now, Brigham Young was clearly opposed to capitalism, and in fact, he founded BYU in part to oppose capitalism, or as he referred to it, the false political economy, which contends against cooperation and the United Order. And that's one of my favorite quotes in light of recent teachings at BYU and so forth. Compared to the opinions of Elder Benson, Joseph Smith and Brigham Young advocated fairly moderate viewpoints. In fact, Brigham Young didn't advocate a lot of governmental change, probably because he was out in Utah away from the government at the time. However, in sharp contrast to Benson's views are those of LDS General Authority and scholar B.H. Roberts. And in his final sermon, Elder Roberts advocated a drastic economic reformation, and this is what he called for. He said, "There is a necessity and a demand for planned and controlled industry by government or government agencies, determination of crops to be planted, and limitation as to their amounts to be authoritatively determined by government. Markets, prices, and sales, foreign and domestic, are to be stipulated ultimately by government, together with labor regulations, working conditions, hours per day, and days per week, almost military control of labor." I'm curious as to whether Ezra Taft Benson ever read that or not. This system would be described by most people today as socialism, although Roberts did not use that word in his speech, and would certainly fit into Elder Benson's viewpoint of socialism. Now, personally, I feel inclined to support progressive taxation and other income equalizing measures because I feel that if an individual's temporal needs are taken care of, he or she has more freedom to pursue spiritual development by gaining knowledge, furthering relationships with others, and giving meaningful service. I'm not going to argue that in the current stages of development in America, capitalism, or I should say, our mixed capitalist socialist system, has not allowed the majority to enter the middle class and lead lives of relative ease and comfort. However, for most of the middle and lower classes, it seems that it is still necessary to focus on economic work if one is to remain in the middle class or even to survive. How many people could quit their job today and still not feel or not feel the effects thereof drastically? By declaring that every man and woman must fend for him or herself, we are in essence saying that spiritual pursuits are only for spare time or only for those who can afford the time to pursue them. While there are some who may claim that those who are serious about spiritual development will find a way to make it happen, it is hypocrisy to have the economic means to help others achieve happiness, but leave them to struggle through the middle or the lower class experience anyway, so that they can grow from doing so. And it seems to me that the belief among the middle class in Utah is that economic work is honorable because it is necessary to support one's family, and family is central to the gospel, so economic work is central to the gospel. However, such focus on economic work devalues any work of a spiritual nature. Now I use spiritual in a broad sense, the sense that I see it in, to include service to others, pursuit of knowledge, development of relationships, sharing of experiences through art and literature, and anything else that helps us understand ourselves as children of heavenly parents and grow to become more like them. While church attendance, paying tithing, keeping the commandments, and service to others are all encouraged under our economic order, some of the other spiritual pursuits are considered as trivial and unnecessary compared to economic work. Now, I will not attempt to validate or devalidate the viewpoint of Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, B.H. Roberts, nor that of Ezra Taft Benson and others who shared his views. I would simply like to point out that Elder Benson's political ideology is mutually exclusive to those of Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and B.H. Roberts. I hope that we can see such viewpoints as opinions based on the understanding these great men had of the gospel and the scriptures, but I wish to point out there's no way that you can collaborate the two. You can't collaborate with, or you can't align the two. I'm searching for a word that I can't find. The two can't go together. What Brigham Young said, the United Order is against capitalism, and what Ezra Taft Benson said, that you can't find some way to make the two fit into one value or one truth system. Now, I do not mean to defame Ezra Taft Benson or sound critical of him. I believe he was called by God to be a prophet and president of the church. I also believe that when political matters are concerned, church leaders are, like the rest of us, entitled to their opinions. Such should be understood and allowed. Denying church authorities of their opinions would be to deny them of their mortality. However, when these opinions are given the weight of official or near-official doctrine, they can become dangerous to free discourse and positive political change. And in solving the problem of income inequality in Utah, a greater sense of political diversity would be helpful. Malman Jensen, an LDS general authority with consent of church leaders in 1998, told the Salt Lake Tribune that it's not in our best interest to be known as a one-party church, referring to the great majority of LDS members who vote Republican. Further, he said that it is regretted that the notion may prevail in some areas that you can't be a good Mormon and a good Democrat at the same time. He said that it would be a very healthy thing for the church, particularly the Utah church, if that notion would be obliterated. Such an attitude of greater political diversity would be helpful in the area of tax policy, simply because it would open the possibilities of new ideas and approaches to the income distribution problems in Utah. And if the notion were obliterated that you can't, I also think there may be a stigma in Utah that being a good Mormon goes with being a good free enterprise capitalist supporter. I think that notion, if it exists, could also be obliterated. And several other stigmas, such as the Puritan work ethic that kind of hold us down, I feel, to a certain political ideology. Progressive taxation is not the only economic area where further discourse and action may be warranted. Other areas, such as health care benefits for the poor and elderly, adequate funding for teachers and education on all levels, and public transportation, to name just a few, could use a more open-minded review by Utah legislators and voters. And perhaps the instructions of Paul to prove all things and hold fast to that which is good are applicable in this situation. I do not think I should hesitate to claim that in regards to Utah's tax code and other economic political policies, among some in the church there has been much holding fast and very little proving. I do not advocate that anyone embrace my opinion. It is simply an opinion and may very well be wrong. As one who does not claim to hold absolute truth, I must admit that. In regards to this and other subjects, I am not suggesting an outright change by church members, merely a look at the other side and an openness to the possibility of change. Thank you.
Nick, I have one admonition for you. Don't apologize for being young. Every morning I get up and I just wished I were young again. And don't feel too bad about your father. At least I'm used to that. Students fall asleep in my class all the time. And at least your dad didn't snap awake and say, "Did I miss anything that's going to be on the test?" Or, "Did you say anything I really need to know?" What I'd like to do today is just spend a few minutes responding a bit to what Nick had to say and also offering some thoughts of my own. Let me say to you that I'm going to suggest that in the beginning I'm going to share with you the three R's. Now, these are not the three R's that we're usually familiar with, reading, writing, and arithmetic. They are the three R's of regret, revelation, and realization. Regret, I'm saddened to learn that our distinguished presenter is planning on going to school at BYU. I wished you were coming to Weber State, and I'd be glad to work with you if that's a possibility. I'm glad that BYU is going to get another fine student. I wish we were, because there's plenty of room for bright young people in higher education today. The second R, revelation. I don't plan on offering any revelation except the revelation that I'm not going to disagree sharply with much of what Nick has said. You may want to do that or not, but I'm not going to. In large measure, I'm going to agree with his basic premises. And realization, the third R. My realization is you're not here really to hear me. You're really to hear him and to engage in dialogue with him. And I think we're going to have plenty of time to do that. There are several scriptures quoted in the presentation, all of which are wonderful ones, both from the Book of Mormon and from the Bible. Let me offer to you one other that's been a particular favorite of mine. "And thus in their prosperous circumstances, they did not send away any who were naked, or that were hungry, or that were athirst, or that were sick, or that had not been nourished. And they did not set their hearts upon riches. Therefore they were liberal to all, both old and young, both bond and free, both male and female, whether out of the church or in the church, having no respect to persons as to those who stood in need." That's from Alma chapter 1, verse 30. I was very interested in the comments about Ezra Taft Benson and Ernest L. Wilkinson. Benson and Wilkinson, I think, as well as anyone, not only them, but as well as anyone, represent what I like to believe was the post a war view of communism and its tie to totalitarianism, a subject that is hard to disagree with in some, and in fact in many ways. I had the opportunity once of interviewing President Benson when I was about your age. I was doing a paper up at the University of Utah on the foreign policies of Henry A. Wallace. And I just decided one day I was going to go down to 47 East South Temple and ask Ezra Taft Benson what he thought about Henry Wallace. So I did, and I must say he was very, very kind and very generous to me. Took time out of his schedule to bring me in and talk to me about the foreign policies. But one thing that I do remember distinctly is that he reached behind him, his desk, and on the shelf pulled out a book called The Biographical Dictionary of the American Left, that was published by the John Birch Society, publishing arm. And I tell you that story because I think you cannot understand Benson if you don't understand the fact that he was saying the things he was saying in that post-war period, and the fact that he was so closely tied to those conservative political views. Ernest Wilkinson is always of interest to me. Ernest Wilkinson's father was the socialist candidate for mayor of Ogden in 1905, a fact that he later tried to explain away by saying he was an immigrant. He didn't understand how things really worked in America. Neither Benson nor Wilkinson believed that a Mormon could be, a good Mormon could also be a socialist. I think they were wrong. In my own research in the early part of the 20th century, John McCormick and I have looked at the history of the Socialist Party in the state of Utah. And what we discovered is that roughly 40% of that political party, including some very active socialists who were elected to office, who served in Socialist Party capacities, were also active members of the LDS Church. When you find names like Wilfred Woodruff Freckleton and Joseph Smith Jessup and Parley Pratt Washburn on the rolls of the Socialist Party, you're pretty sure these people are not Congregationalists or Methodists. Freckleton, for example, was elected to the city council in Eureka, Utah. Midway through his term, he was called on an LDS mission. He served his mission honorably, came back to Eureka, and was reelected to the city council as a socialist. That was before the Russian Revolution. That was a different time in our history. Benson and Wilkinson represented the prevailing views of their time. Freckleton and Jessup and others had a different worldview. How do we make the two worldviews come together? Nick has spoken in great length about the tax system, a subject I know very little about. The only thing I know about taxes is come next Wednesday I have to file another extension because I haven't finished for the extension I filed in April. So believe me, I'm not here to give you any advice on the question of taxes. Let me try a different tack if I could. Karl Marx, go ahead and boo, hiss if you want. Karl Marx once observed that the idea in every historical epoch, the ideas of the ruling class are the ruling ideas. Okay. Let's change that just a little bit and say, let's leave out the term class. Class makes people really uneasy. When I say to my students in American history, when we're talking about late 19th and early 20th century, that we are a class-based society, they get very, very nervous. They don't like that notion. They like to believe that there is a class in America. It's called the middle class. And whether you make $10,000 a year or $100,000 a year, you're in that large middle class. I argue with them and say, no, we live in a very class-based society. Those people sitting courtside at the Delta Center are not simply the most loyal and knowledgeable fans of basketball. I got on an airplane recently in Chicago. Here's what happened on Delta Airlines, the most class-based airline in the world. We boarded from the middle of the plane so that the first-class passengers could enter without, you know, having to deal with mere mortals like you and me. And then we deplaned in Salt Lake from the front so they could also leave the plane without having to deal with the refuse of life. We boarded by platinum, we boarded by silver, we boarded by gold, and then at one point I felt that someone was going to say to the rest of us, now the rest of you sorry human beings that don't fit that category can get on the plane. We live in a class-based society. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know. You could debate that. What are the ruling ideas in our society, globally and locally? What are the ideas that rule the way we see the world? As citizens of the world, as Americans, as Westerners, as Utahns, as Mormons, whatever subcategory you want to list, what are those ruling ideas? And how do they help us understand the kind of society we create, the kind of values that we have? There's a wonderful quote from Ford Motor, I believe, official who said, yes, we understand that SUVs are dangerous. Yes, we understand that they are wasteful. Yes, we understand that they are gas guzzlers. But we are going to continue to produce them because people like them and people buy them. Is that a ruling idea of our time? It is indeed. What other kinds of ruling ideas do we have that set the tone for the society in which we live in globally and locally? Healthcare. What better this society would be if there were universal, affordable, single-payer healthcare? What are the spin-offs of that idea? I'll tell you a spin-off for me. I'd retire a whole lot earlier and allow some bright young student to take my job if I knew that I could retire at, say, 55. I've been doing what I've been doing for 30 years now. Good Lord, it's time for me to give it up. But why don't I retire? Because my health care is very closely tied to where I work. If there was universal, affordable health care, boy, it would seriously help me to make a decision earlier and open up the job market for other people. Education. What kind of ruling value, ruling ideas does education play in our society? Is education, the commitment to education for everybody, still a prevailing idea? I don't know. I don't think there are going to be as many people like me 50 or 100 years from now, because I think we're going to take education and we're going to privatize it and we're going to put it on the internet, and that's going to be great in some ways because you'll be able to pick and choose, and you won't have to go to BYU or Snow or Weber. You can sit at home and download the best historian in America's lecture on history and the best economist. Now, where the rest of those teachers of history and economy are going to go, I don't know. And how we're going to miss that interaction between student and faculty member, I don't know. What are the ruling ideas in our society? We hear a lot about the social welfare system we live in. Despite 75 years of an active attempt on the part of some people, at least, to change the nature of our society, the class distinction in our society, globally and locally, is very much the same as it was when Franklin Roosevelt said, "I see a nation that is ill-clad, ill-housed, and ill-fed." Those are still serious problems. Hard work, is that a value? It is a value. Do I believe in hard work? I do. I believe in work. I believe work is vocation. I don't do what I do at Weber only because I need the money, which I do, but I do it because I think I can make a contribution. And sometimes I'm there Saturdays, and sometimes I'm there Sundays, and sometimes I leave early on Tuesday. They're very much linked in my mind, work is vocation. I believe in hard work. I think hard work ought to translate into a better economic living for most people. If hard work were the only criteria for wealth, there'd be a lot more wealthy people. I'm reminded of a friend of mine named Fred Harris, who was a senator from Oklahoma. He ran for president in 1972 or 76, and people used to say to him, "Oh, this running for president is pretty hard work, isn't it, Fred?" He said, "I don't know. I used to pick cotton for a living. It's not that hard." Hard work, is it a value? Yeah. Is it a value that really translates into a more secure economic system? I'm not sure. I know lots of people who are full-time employees working hard who don't have health care, who don't have child care, who don't have education. A society decides it's going to make something happen, and it makes it happen. Kennedy said, "We're going to put a man on the moon by the end of that decade." And unless you believe the folks who think it was all a total hoax, we did that. And with whatever it took to make that happen, our society said, "That's an important value. We'll make it happen." We decided locally here we were going to have the Olympics. Come hell or high water or I-15 or whatever, whatever it took, believe me, we would not have gotten those changes in the freeway for any other reason. We were willing to do it. What does a society value? Is it possible that a society can value a collectivist kind of a future without the kinds of problems that Wilkinson and Benson were concerned with? Is it possible to have a communitarian or collectivist society without totalitarianism? Now, some Mormons would say, absolutely, that's what the United Order is all about. And other critics would say, yes, but the very nature of a communitarian approach led to tension, it led to class division, all kinds of things. I don't know. Someone asked Michael Harrington one time if the Democratic Party was a socialist, the Democratic Party's platform was a socialist. And his response was, no, it's not. It isn't even half that good. I'm not sure the Democratic Party platform is the answer. I'm not sure socialism is the answer. I'm not sure progressive taxation is the answer. I'm not sure what the answer is, but I do know that part of finding the answer comes and consideration of different viewpoints, and all of us ought to do that. Let me close with one last Karl Marx quote. Marx said at one point in the thesis on Feuerbach, I believe, he said, philosophers talk about interpreting the world. The point is, he said, to change it. The point is to change it, to bring about the better kind of society that we've been taught through the scriptures, through the teachings of LDS church leaders, and from other sources. That's the point. How do we bring about that kind of a society? How do we make those kinds of values become the ruling values in this historical epoch? Thanks very much.
Thank you, Nick, for a very interesting presentation, and John, for your response. We have about 15 minutes for questions, and because it's easy to just come up here and say them into the microphone, I'd invite you to do that so we don't have to repeat the question. And if you don't, then we'll have Nick repeat it. You had a question.
The proposal, the particular proposal for working towards economic equity that you've proposed in this paper is relatively moderate, you know, progressive taxation. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, first of all, how far are you willing to go with your commitment to economic equity? What do you believe is the best way for societies to implement economic equity? Is it socialism? Is it communism? What is it? And second of all, a follow-up to that would be, what are you doing as an individual to work towards whatever that agenda is?
Well, personally, I think my paper is a little more moderate than my personal viewpoints. I would consider myself a socialist, lower class. Well, I mean, lowercase. Excuse me, lowercase s. I don't have any allegiance to any socialist party or know if there really is one anymore or whatever. But I would consider myself. I do believe in socialism and maybe even communism, depending on how you define communism, lowercase c, definitely. I believe that a so-called classless society would be more beneficial to all of us, both spiritually and economically. And mostly my belief in socialism or in a classless economy isn't simply to feed and clothe everyone, but it's because I believe that, like the scripture says, the love of money is the root of all evil, and that the capitalism, I believe, encourages the love of money, and it sets up, like that quote I read where redistributing the wealth is a disincentive to achieve. Well, our current system is based upon economic achievement, I believe, as opposed to real spiritual and intellectual and other achievement, which I feel has a higher value. And so I feel that the socialistic society would put spiritual things and intellectual things and things of a higher value where they belong. I think it would put our values in the right order and put spiritual things above economic things, whereas I believe under capitalism, economic things come above spiritual things and intellectual things and relationships with others and almost everything else for some people. And so, but also I don't believe that we can just change it, you know, that we can just have socialism in America. I don't think we can just convert over and retool America for socialism. Because when I'd have conversations with some of my friends at school and so forth about the subject, they were like, well, what do you propose we do? We can't just change to socialism, you know? And in a way that they're right, that we can't just change all of a sudden from what we are to something else. But I believe that there's measures politically that can be done, and that's what progressive taxation was one of those issues. And I think the other issues, like John mentioned, were healthcare and education. You know, I mean, I don't think that we value education, right? Because we don't pay teachers the same that we pay other people with a similar degree. I mean, obviously, that shows where our value of education is. And say public transportation. I think we could do much with public transportation. And John mentioned the SUVs and the vehicles on our roads and our freeways. I look at and I think that we're using way too much resources, driving cars around way too much. And I think that a public transportation system in Utah that was improved and enhanced greatly would do, and if people actually rode it, this is the way I think public transportation should be in Utah. The tracks train should go from Logan to St. George. Now that might sound a little extreme, or at least from Brigham City down to Spanish Fork, at least. And you should be able to get on the tracks for free, and you should have to pay to drive on I-15. That's what I believe about public transportation in Utah. Yes? Okay. Okay. I'll hurry up with this one so there can be more questions. But it's to answer what I'm personally doing, I think that in my personal life, what I'm doing to contribute to economic equality or to oneness, I think the most important thing I can do is share what I have with others, which isn't very much. But if I see someone on the street, for example, I like to think that I would, you know, give that someone some cash if I had it on me, but I don't think that necessarily does a whole lot. But I would do that and have done that. But what personally I think the most important thing that I can do or anyone else can do is encourage free discussion of these ideas in a political arena and different educational arena and so forth of ideas that might lead to change. And so personally what I feel I could do to that is just what I'm doing by presenting these ideas. Of course, I'm probably preaching to the choir, maybe not. But talking about these ideas, I think, is one important thing. Next.
Gosh, where does one start? I really support the premise of both the speakers. Excellent presentations. I'm Stan Hovey from Tempe, Arizona. Arizona also has a similar problem with a very regressive tax system. During one of my annual pilgrimages to my home state, I read in the Tribune several years ago, they were interviewing the state head of economic development. And he was talking about the need of, reducing the corporate tax structure in order to bring in all the outside businesses. One of his arguments was that Utah has one of the highest birth rates in the country. And consequently, in order to keep ahead of this huge mass of population that's growing here, they had to work very, very hard to bring in outside businesses. My question to both of you is, how valid is that viewpoint from your point of view? Thanks.
I've heard that before, and if anyone has ever heard Mike Levitt speak, you've heard similar things to that. I think that is a good point that has been made by people in Utah a lot, that we need to bring in these outside businesses, and so that's why we have that low corporate income tax rate and so forth. But I don't see businesses like Novell and businesses like some of these other big ones in Utah, the computer industry and so forth. I don't see them as doing anything to provide food and shelter and clothing for anybody in Utah. I think we have adequate agriculture in Utah that we can provide for everybody, and so we don't need this outside influence. I think that there's other solutions we can look for, as far as if we have this growing population, which we do, of course, that there's other solutions we can look for to provide for them within Utah instead of bringing other people outside of Utah. And it's kind of, I think, hypocritical to say that we have to screw those people, you know, economically, so we can bring in the big people who are going to provide, you know. And it basically sets up a class system where these big businesses, you know, set the tone in Utah. And that's very much the tone that's set in Utah by our governor, I believe, and by much of the legislature, that this is, you know, business-friendly Utah. And I think that's one of the things the Olympics is all about, is bringing business to Utah. And so we're all big on the economic, you know, let's bring business to Utah and technology especially. And I think that we're selling out some of our most valuable resources and most valuable and selling out to business a lot by doing that. And I think that, especially as far as education is concerned, in the most recent State of the State address, which, when is that given?
January.
Yeah, last January, in that State of the State address, Governor Leavitt talked about being education-minded and tech-savvy, and he used those in the same sentence very often, and his whole thrust on education is to change it to meet the demands of that industry that he wants to bring in and that people want to bring in Utah. And I think that's really sad, is we're just going to sell out our whole higher education system, our public education, higher education system, to those technical, you know, giants. And I think that once those businesses go away and once we're gone, we're going to be left with a bunch of people who are trained how to run computers that we don't use anymore. I'm reminded of a Hugh Nibley article I read, or it was probably a transcript of a talk in an article, where he said that one school district once traded out history for teaching of dry cleaning. And now dry cleaning is not in high demand anymore. And I think that's kind of what we're doing in Utah, is we're focusing on the temporal with that, trying to attract the businesses rather than the spiritual. Do you have something to add?
No. You were next. Come on.
I'm going to say something just briefly and come around it. Utah has one of the lowest take-home pay of any state in the nation. Only three or four southern states pay less than we do here. We have one of the most regressive tax systems. If you earn $250,000 a year, you're paying 4.4%. If you earn $30,000 a year, you're paying 9.8%. If you earn $15,000, you're paying almost 20%. That counts income taxes, property taxes, sales taxes, and franchise taxes. 3 years ago, the legislature passed a law that rather than taxes on cars, we pay, well, like my friend in St. George was paying $600 for his Cadillac, okay? My son was paying $40 for his old Toyota. Now, my friend pays $150, and my son pays $80. His doubled. It was revenue neutral. Now, the legislature, I'm just saying this, that we're getting shafted. And why aren't the Mormon leaders interested in these poor tithe payers, you know, in the state? This is kind of nasty, but one of the general authorities, remember the Corps of 12, went up in the Emigration Canyon. They've got these new condos going up there, okay? It's 9,000 square foot condo. He's got one, okay, a little over $1 million. One of his co-workers, that wasn't big enough for him. He has an 18,000 square foot one. And you know, it seems it's almost obscene. And why? Who cares? None of my friends care. We got six people here walking the path. We care a little bit, maybe. But my friends don't care about it. All they know is that, doggone it, gay is evil, and abortion is a terrible, terrible thing. And so we got to vote Republican. President Benson was asked. Is it possible for a good Mormon to be a liberal Democrat? And he said, no. Not if he were living the gospel and understood it. Okay? And that's what it is. In 1970, the old house of our legislature were controlled by the Democrats. Well, I say they were, except when they reorganized. There's 29 senators, okay? There was an independent there, and let's see his name. Peterson, who was a Democrat from Magna, voted with the Republicans to organize the Senate. And that, in combination with President Benson's concept and some of the other brethren, we're now almost completely Republican. I did a letter to the editor recently in which I said this, and I kind of paraphrased, and I'm taking too much time, aren't I? I kind of paraphrased Lowell Bunyan. He said, there is no true spirituality, that is, relationship with God, without social morality. And I was responding to a letter by Paul Sharp, which he belittled Clinton, said the river of lies and all that. My perspective is, Clinton is more moral, was more moral, than most of the, than all the legislatures, more, all the Republican legislatures in our, on our, in Utah here. It really is. If you tell, if you say that morality is more than sex.
I'm going to have one more question. Come on up here. I know you were eager too, but we're going to have to do that one afterwards.
Just make a quick comment. I recommend a book, and I wish I remember the full title, The Fourth Great Awakening by, it's on egalitarianism. Excellent book.
Just recently published.
Recently published, yeah, June of 2000, I believe. So I recommend that book for our listeners, but I guess my point is, in that book, he talks a lot about capitalism, a little bit how it helped society, but that's not his main point. One point I want to mention is, what has capitalism done for us? 100 years ago, 90% of us would all have been in the poverty level. Now that level is, what is it now? I'm not certain, but it's maybe 20%. What I'm trying to say is, capitalism has done an awful lot as well. I happen to agree with a lot of your viewpoints, though. I am a Democrat in this state also. So we need to improve it. We need to improve egalitarianism here. But poo-pooing capitalism does not benefit us. It's greatly benefited us. We are greatly, much more equal we are today than we were 100 years ago. We're all much more, have more time for the humanities that you speak so highly of. We have much more time for the humanities now than we ever did 100 years ago. So we are getting there.
Somebody does.
Thank you very, very much. And thank you all for coming. A tape will be available of this session if you're interested in buying it. Thank you.
What were your parents? Did you like people?
No, I was writing.